the Business on RTE Radio 1 with AIB. You see it, we help you do it. AIB, for the life you're after.
But first, on Monday, it will be 2 years since an explosion in the town of Chrysla in County Donegal killed 10 people and devastated a close-knit community. This week, the families of the victims called on the government to set up a public inquiry into the tragedy. Our first guest was in Chrysla that day. Jason Black was lucky to survive. His cousin, Martina Martin, was killed in the tragedy. The fallout has left its own mark on a man who has endured many challenges. As well as a lifetime in business, running bars, shops, a nightclub, he now runs expeditions to mountains around the world, helping people to achieve their personal goals. He is one of just three Irish men to have climbed K2. He's reached the summit of Mount Everest 8 times. By his own admission, he's a man who likes to live on the edge. Earlier this week, I visited him at his home outside Letterkenny in Donegal. Jason, hello.
Hey, Richard. How are you? You're very welcome.
Thank you very much. Very nice to meet you. It's a beautiful day in Donegal. You've lovely views of hills and mountains here.
It's always a great day in Donegal. You're so welcome to my home. Come in.
Thank you. Were you always interested in mountaineering?
Probably not. I would say I was more interested in the great outdoors. I had a real baptism of fire when I was a young boy at 7 years of age. Growing up in Donegal, I was introduced to the great outdoors by two very inspirational leaders, Maurice Graham and Dizzy McConnell, both scout leaders, and they introduced me to the rivers, the lakes, the mountains of Donegal, and from there, the fire of where I've ended up today began. When I think back, you know, I was given a compass at 8 years of age by Maurice Graham, and in 2018, I stood on the summit of K2, one of the greatest mountains on the planet, and I had the same compass in my hand, and I feel like my life had gone 360 degrees, literally, you know, starting out as a young boy, and never in my wildest imagination did I ever think that I would have the opportunity to climb the greatest mountains on the planet. That's where the fire was lit.
Growing up, cars were big in the family, weren't they? The whole family, going back a few generations, were very interested in motor vehicles.
Yeah, my daddy was a motor mechanic. We came from a very simple life. My mum and dad were very simple folk from on the outskirts of Letterkenny. My daddy was a very hard-working motor mechanic that fixed cars at the side of the house. Mum was an even harder-working housewife. But we came from a very loving home, came from a very caring home. And thankfully, when I look back today, from a home that allowed us to roam, allowed us the freedom of adventure and exploration.
One of your brothers, sadly, was killed in a motorbike accident. That was in the 1990s.
Yeah.
Billy,
yeah. Yeah, Billy was a motor mechanic. He was definitely my father's son in a relation to his hands, his engineering brain. We lost Billy in 1997 on a motorbike accident in America. I was there with him and fell off, and unfortunately Billy was killed. And it was a very, very challenging time in our life, because Billy was my best friend and archenemy, as we are growing up.
Give each other a hard time.
Oh yeah, all the time. It was brilliant. He was a super athlete as well. I think he was better than I was. He just had that natural ability. But we were very competitive, hugely competitive. Great guy. Miss him dearly. I miss the fact that he missed so much. So that's a huge loss. But you know what? In the mountains, I get to walk with Billy every day, and that's something I find very precious.
Going to school. Did you enjoy school?
I loved national school, particularly a little country school here in the outskirts of Letterkenny. There's only 25 in the class. Never had a school uniform. Daddy used to drop us down in a Leyland Sherpa van and pick up a whole lot of neighbours on the way past. With no seat belts in it, we would be tumbling down the road, and maybe 10 or 15 would exit, and into school we went. And I had a great time there. And unfortunately, then I went to secondary school, leaving the country and headed into Letterkenny. To a bigger school, St. Union's College. I remember going in with Mum and getting my grey slacks and my blazer and my shirt and tie, and getting the copybooks and with the cellophane cover on the back of them. And I remember that morning getting the Lochswilly bus, which was my first time ever on a bus, and I was so excited about getting picked up at 8:30 at the bottom of the lane and trundling to town. But unfortunately for me, that's whenever the wheels of my life fell apart and came off.
Why? What happened, Jason?
Well, I fell victim to an extremely violent bully, Richard. I never seen it coming. I was going in with the joy, and I was small. I wasn't the person that I am today, and I was probably a green a greenhorn, or certainly green behind the ears, and I was seen coming. So for 6 years, physically, mentally, emotionally, I was bullied.
This was one person?
Yeah, one individual. And every day from 10 past 9 in the morning till 4 o'clock in the evening, it was physical. It was verbal at times, and it had sinister acts in it where the school bag would go missing because I wasn't strong enough to say what had happened, even though I knew what had happened. The teacher would confront me, and that would lead to more punishment, which was just a spiraling chaos of physical, mental, and emotional abuse.
What sort of impact did that have then?
I would come home from school, I would throw the bag in the corner because that school bag represented that bully, that I'd lost the love for education completely. I was a really intuitive and smart young man, a young boy, but just everything about school represented the feeling of suppression, the feeling of fear. In the morning, meeting my breakfast and the hair standing on the back of my neck, you know, and that doesn't leave you. I can still even think, I can still feel that emotion even when I'm speaking these words. I do think Mum and Dad probably twigged something was going on, but you know, I think everything's relative. You know, back in the 80s, we didn't have the support systems. We didn't have the confidence to speak about bullying, or the confidence to speak about a youthful depression, which without doubt is what I was struggling with.
At the end of secondary school, in a way, it must have felt like a bit of a release that was all over. But had it affected your school performance, your own thoughts about your own career?
Yeah, look, my saving grace during that period of time was nature. You know, I would just run and run and run and climb and climb and climb, and I was running away completely. And then, you know, I didn't get an education because everything about that was about the bully. So I left school, secondary school, with no junior cert and no leaving cert. You know, but the next bully that I didn't see coming, Richard, was society, because I didn't have the credentials. I didn't have the piece of paper that says A, B and C. I couldn't get a job. The road ahead for me was extremely black at the time. I was really struggling with what I know today as a youthful depression. I didn't know what that was at the time back then, but by God, was I struggling to the point where I genuinely felt the world was a better place without Jason there. I had planned the day to take my life. I thought that it's time for me to leave.
What stopped you? What pulled you back from that?
Nature. Mother Nature caught me at a time when I wanted to leave, and just didn't judge me, because society was judging me, the body was judging me, the lack of an education was judging me, not being able to get a job was judging me, but nature wasn't. Nature just let me grow, run, scream, cry, and make peace.
I want to talk about some of the mountains that you've climbed. We're here in the front room in your house, and you've got this fantastic photographic collection of you on the top of all kinds of places. This one here is this is Everest, is it?
Yeah, so that's Mount Everest. That's Mount Everest. That's a really important one to me for a couple of reasons. One is I was very inspired in 1993 by Dustin Stelfox and their first ascent, the first Irish ascent on Mount Everest. You know, as a young boy, you know, a young man, I was really struggling at the time, and I went along to a talk that Dustin and the team were giving, and they were talking about the trials, the tribulations and the battles of what it was climbing to Mount Everest, and I was the guy swinging at the back trying to be cool and trying to not let on that I was absolutely busting at the seams with the joy of listening to this incredible journey. I was kind of awkwardly walking around the place while they were answering questions and taking photographs. And I got Dawson on his own, and I said, "Dawson, I'm just blown away by the story." And he asked me to give him a little insight into his life. And I told him about my scouting life. I told him about my battles with life. And I told him where I was at the time. I told him about my passion for nature. And he wrote me a message inside the booklet, which now hangs on the wall, which is signed by Dawson and Dermot and the team. And he said,
what does it say?
Jason, never stop following your dreams in life. And that lit an incredible flame for me. And it hangs on inside that picture alongside my certificate from the summit of Mount Everest, along with a rock from the summit, and alongside it, my own photograph hanging, holding the tricolour above my head. When I look at this, it's more than Everest, Richard. This is me standing on my own shoulders. during my time in preparation and even climbing this mountain, I couldn't afford to climb the mountain, first of all, so I couldn't do the commercial side, which is through Nepal. I had to go through Tibet in China. So I wrote to the Chinese aviation authorities and they gave me the permit. I could afford the permit and I got goodwill from a lot of people that supported me financially. And I went there on my own and I took the mountain on in a solo nature and put in my own route, carried my own gear. And I wanted to do it that way because I felt I had to battle through life. And even in Mount Everest, I thought I had dealt with the pain of the bully. I thought I had dealt with the pain of losing Mammy from cancer at 17. She was 46 years of age. Mum got breast cancer, which was hugely debilitating for her family. And I thought I had dealt with that. But really and truly, all I had done was just suppressed the emotion of it and moved on in life and buried it. But with the silence of these big 8,000 metre mountains and no intrusion from phones, emails, text messages, nothing but your mind. And for me, my mind was screaming. I didn't see it coming. And I had a complete breakdown in the mountain. And I spent 10 days in there crying, wailing, venting, and trying to make peace with me. So when I stood on the summit after 2 months, I stood there at 7 a.m. in the morning on my own. There wasn't a single person on the summit. I realized that I had overcome the battles of life and that I was stronger than I had ever given myself credit for. So my Everest wasn't Everest the mountain, my Everest was me.
I see here as well, Jason, K2 is on the wall, a picture of you on K2.
Yeah, K2, the daddy of all, 8,611 metres. It is the Olympic medal in mountaineering.
You're one of only three Irish people to have climbed to the summit of K2, and you're the only one who's alive today.
Yeah, sadly, Jerry MacDonald in 2008, who was the first, you know, he was the innovator from an Irish mountaineering perspective. He had gone off and taken on so much in his life. And on 2008, he was part of a Norwegian team. A piece of the Serac had collapsed and taken out a team below.
The Serac is like a big wall of ice, is it?
Yeah, Serac's about the size of 10 cathedrals. It hangs at 8,000 metres just below the summit, so we've got to climb underneath it up to the bottleneck, and we've got to traverse across, literally the width of your boots, left to right, on a 100 metre, very, very, very challenging section. It's very technical. On the left-hand side, there's at least 1,500 metres of a vertical drop into the abyss below. And then we turn right and we go up what we call today the elevator and up onto the summit. Sadly, you know, when they got there, an experienced mountaineer knows the timing. They're going to have to back climb down at night time, which on a mountain like that is absolutely virtually impossible. So anyway, they got down and there was the team below were injured from the piece of the Serac that collapsed. And Jared couldn't pass. I believe it was his Irishness as a mountaineer that encouraged him to stay and to cut down the other climbers that were still alive. I think Jared done the right thing as a mountaineer. He helped. And unfortunately, another piece of the Serac collapsed. And the footage that was shot from Camp 4 shows that they were hit. And then under investigation, and it was found out they were all killed. So Jared lost his life on K2 in 2008. He was the first Irishman ever to get to the summit, but sadly didn't get off the mountain.
K2 is a difficult mountain just even to get to. Tell me about some of the security risks and the lengths you have to go to get there.
Yeah, so, you know, we fly into Islamabad and, you know, transported on what they call the KKH, and this very, very remote network of roads that takes us to K2, into a village called Skardu. We were on a bus for 70 hours, the team. We had to have two security on board carrying Glock guns. We had a cavalcade in front and behind. We had eight in each jeep carrying AK-47s, and they were trying to keep us safe. The year before, that same bus was stopped, and it was American climbers heading in, and they shot and killed all the climbers.
And that would have been Taliban, would it?
Taliban, which we actually got stopped with on the way back. On the way back in 2015, we got stopped by the Taliban, taken off the bus and held hostage. And ultimately, what they were looking for was money. So we had a liaison officer from the army on board, from the Air Corps actually, and he was able to negotiate on our behalf.
Your expedition up K2 in 2015, you didn't make it to the top. What happened?
No, unfortunately, we got hit with an avalanche at Camp 4. So part of my team was down in Camp 3 down below. Noel was down there. Noel Hanna, who sadly lost his life last year, and Anna Perner, he was another K2 successful summit here. So there's three of us that's been up there, myself, Noel, and Jer. Two are gone, and I'm here today. But
after being hit by the avalanche in 2015 and not making it, you went back and you made it in 2018. Were you not scared?
Yeah, 15 was devastating, you know, because you put all your energy, financial, emotional, physical, you know, everything goes into an expedition. Not only are you on an expedition, but your family are. And people don't see that, you know. It is a very selfish thing we do, but it is who we are. And again, I just don't want to be judged by society, because society's done that for long enough. It's just let me be me and let me do what I like to do in life.
What did Sharon, your wife, say to you when you made it back in 2015, alive and well, and at some point you said to her, I want to go back and do this again?
Yeah, look, in 15, you know, the avalanche broke, came right through. Two of the team were killed. I made the phone call on the sat phone, told Sharon what had happened, and I was on making my way out. And then you come home to the devastation of failure, of not achieving. I suppose the very funny side of it is when Sharon would see the red wine coming in the two glasses, she gets a bit nervous because she realises there's a question coming at the end of it.
So there's a conversation and a request.
A conversation, generally difficult. But Sharon's a very special individual. Anybody that's ever met Sharon knows that she's an incredible human being. And she said something to me really, really poignant. She says, Jason, I married you, but I don't own you. And I thought, that sums up our marriage. You know, she lets me be myself within our marriage, and I do the same to Sharon. And I think that's why we have been so successful. We've made a promise to each other, a very deep promise, that if I ever get to somewhere that's not making sense, that I have the courage to turn around and leave it alone and have the chance to return another day.
What was the most frightened you've ever been on a mountain?
I think watching your own fellow mountaineers perish in front of you. There is no cotton wool, there is nobody coming to save you.
And did that happen in 2015 on K2?
It happened to me in Everest in 2013. It happened to me in Namgyal, another fantastic mountaineer. There's only 25 of us in there. I'm taking on a very, very quiet side of the mountain. There's nobody there. And Namgyal and myself were eating the night before, and next day he's climbing and he suffers cerebral edema, which is the brain swell, and unfortunately perished. And at those high altitudes, you can't take them back. You know, all I did was I opened his arms up, I put the goggles on his face, I put a cylinder of oxygen in behind his head, and I said, "In our Father," and made peace with his death, and hopefully he's in a happier place today. And then on K2, the same in 2015, we lost two climbers. You know, it's. I hate to use the terminology. It's an occupational hazard. We know when we play with fire in these environments that in order to punch through, there is a major risk. It's always been there.
Today, you do a lot of different things and organise a lot of trips separate to your own mountaineering expeditions. Is it a difficult thing to try and organise a trip for someone on the other side of the world in terms of equipment and logistics and maybe even getting the animals or the donkeys needed to carry stuff into the mountain?
Yeah, it's hugely challenging. The second half of my athletic chapter or mountaineering chapter is now about running trips for others to grow. It's hugely challenging, you know. Whether I'm trying to get donkeys, the other day I was trying to get a team of donkeys in the middle of Mendoza up in the mountains, and this farmer has 25 donkeys. I need him to be at a certain intersection on a certain date. On the 17th of January, I need that farmer with 25 donkeys to be at that corner to meet my expedition so that we can go in to take on a huge mountain in there and a 360-degree. So we're doing a traverse on the mountain, which is quite unorthodox.
So how do you do that? You get him on the phone and he says, "I will be there with the donkeys." And what if he's not?
Yeah, well, if he's not, then I don't know what I'm going to do. But this is how it's been done for years. These are the old trading ways of doing it. Yes, there's a more modern way of doing it in some cases today, but in some really remote environments, that's the way it is. It's the same in Pakistan. Nepal's a little bit more modernized today. We've seen the use of helicopters and so on. So, but again, There's still yaks needed, there's still farmers there, you still have to communicate with them. They have traditions of how they do it. There's a blessing of the donkeys, there's a blessing of the yaks, there's a blessing of the climbers. There's fabulous, fabulous traditions that hasn't been lost through the fabric of pure mountaineering. And this is, for me, I'm all about culture, I'm all about the music, the dance, the celebration of life. And by the way, we're climbing a mountain. So the mountains always last for me, and it's tradition and the celebration of the humanity is the most important part.
What about all of those local people that do an awful lot of the legwork, the porters who carry all the gear? Do you think at times within the climbing community they're not fully appreciated or respected, and the reality of their lives is so different to the reality of the lives of the clients that are going up?
That's a really, really great question. And it's a question that times, and an answer that haunts me. And it very much haunted me back in my early days as a mountaineer. I mean, I'm talking about pre-Facebook, pre-Instagram. You know, we were climbing as pure, pure mountaineers, putting in the routes, pulling the gear through ourselves, establishing the route, putting in the camps, and we were working with fabulous Sherpa and fabulous guides from each continent that we were working with. But unfortunately, with the explosion of mountaineering and the explosion, the coolness of it all, we can see all these Instagram photographs and all these wannabes that want that perfect photograph. And unfortunately, it's coming at the peril of these people, because these people have a lot of money, these other mountaineers that are coming in. And there's a sense of bastardization that's going on in these mountains, because they want these people to carry their gear up. They don't want to put the route in. They don't want to do the legwork, but they want all the success. And so much so that they won't even acknowledge or recognize the fact it's with their support that they would never have got to these hallowed places. So for me, I find that really, really difficult and challenging. Hence the reason why I left the south side of Everest, because I could see the way they were abusing the people, the environment, leaving oxygen behind, leaving their human waste behind, and just not really being pure to the essence of what a mountaineer is. And
is it realistic to bring everything back out, Jason? Can you do that?
Yeah, that is our duty. Our duty is, you know, we pack in, pack out. That's the law we live by as pure climbers. You know, the likes of human waste, the likes of oxygen tanks, the likes of gear, it's not acceptable to leave that behind. And it's not acceptable on any terms to leave anything behind. And I think there's an apprenticeship to being a mountaineer. You've got to start at the bottom. You know, for me, it started on Errigal in Donegal and ended up on Everest.
Jason, you've seen your own share, more than your fair share, of tragedies in the mountains that you've climbed. Much closer to home, 2 years ago in Krisla, there was the explosion. Several people killed. You were in the vicinity that day. What happened?
Yeah, I was coming from Dunfanaghy. I was working on a fireplace. I was doing some stonework at the side of a fireplace. And my daughter Ella needed picked up from school. I was making my way through Krisla. You have to come through Krisla to get to Letterkenny from Dunfanaghy. And my cousin Martina was working in the store. I was just doing the normal thing. I was just going to swing in for a cup of coffee, have a quick hello, and get on with my business by picking my daughter up. Ella, I can't remember whether she texted me or messaged me or one of these voice things, and I'm listening to it on the phone. And as I look up, I could see that the car park was quite busy that day at the shop, and I just pulled in just before the car park to take the call or to finish the message with Ella. And just as I got out of the car, just up it went, and it just exploded. And it was this very deep, deep, deep thud. It wasn't a very high-pitched sound. It was just this big boom. And then all of a sudden, it was a yellow-coloured kind of dust was floating around the place, and everything was just carnage. The forecourt tin underneath the canopy underneath the petrol station was hanging down. There was car alarms going off. And I just started running towards the shop. I was there within seconds and turned into the store and just couldn't believe what I could see. And
you must have been in huge shock yourself.
Yeah, I don't even know. My own state of mind was just fight, flight or freeze. Richard, you know, I just gone into SOS mode. You know, as a highly trained mountaineer, we're taught to deal with avalanches. We're trained as, you know, first aiders and a wilderness first aider. You know, it's not the same. I arrived at the front door and quite quickly there was one or two other gentlemen arrived. One guy in particular was amazing. He was from Muckish Mountain Quarry. Blocks were everywhere, you know, the 6-inch concrete blocks were there was piles of them everywhere. You know, but again, I don't know, whatever is in your adrenaline at the time. We were moving blocks like they were sweets to try to get the weight off the person. And then as other people were arriving, I was trying to give them jobs.
Absolutely traumatic, Jason. How do you ever get over or work through something like that? You'll never forget it. Does it stay with you? Are you reminded of it often?
Yeah, for a long time. You know, even the sound and the smells, even walking on the produce in the store that day, you know, the glass and the water, you know, and above my head, the electricity was still alive and it was bouncing off the RSJs and was igniting on the RSJs. And I remember the very strong, a very, very clear, strong, potent smell of wine. And I could smell the red wine and the juices, you know, it was horrible, horrible smells. And I'll never forget looking over my right shoulder and seeing the white helmet of the first ambulance guy come through the door. His name was Michael. And I was never as delighted to see the emergency services arrive and for me to hand over my duty to them to get them to deal with it on a professional level. And everybody was so good that day. There was a lot of, it's quite public, the amount of local people that came and helped out. They were just, you know, this human chain of blocks was just phenomenal to witness.
What do you do when you come home that evening when that is over and just try and make sense of that and process what you've seen and what you've done and the trauma of it?
Well, I lost my cousin, Martina. She was killed in the explosion. She was one of the employees working in behind the counter. She was the girl I was going to visit for the coffee. So I was dealing with the death of my cousin. I was dealing with the effects of the trauma of the explosion, attending the funerals. And I kind of felt as a bit of a duty that I had been there with them to the bitter end. And I just wanted to see it out. So that was me kind of dealing with it myself. So I kind of went to the funerals with Sharon's support. And then ultimately then we buried our own Martina and her funeral. And I kind of bottled it up and went into that typical Irish big man attitude. And I'm okay, I'm fine. And the cracks started to slowly appear. Sharon could see them. Simple tasks like, you know, I would have, you know, as a climber, I was trying to keep my business going and I was trying to do things. And simple three tasks, I would come home and I could get nothing done. I could hardly make a phone call.
Were you physically injured yourself?
I lost my hearing on my right side, so I broke the bones in my right ear, which had been traumatic for me. And it left me with air pressure issues on the right-hand side and, you know, the fear of not being able to climb again. But I ended up getting PTSD, which I didn't even know really and truly what it was and what the effects were. I was very thankful that my dad and my dad's neighbour, Caramel, who's a psychiatric nurse in Altna Galvin, introduced me to a guy that had worked with the people from the OMA bombing. He was tremendous. He got me straight away, understood me, and through quite a bit of work, he was able to untangle the web to allow me to, A, first breathe and exist, and then eventually start to make peace with the trauma. And then I had to step into the operating theatre then to try to get the bones built in my ear. So I've just got those done through the summer, so haven't been able to climb internationally. So I've had to park all that up right through the summer. But delighted to say from the 1st of October, I'm able to fly again. I'm able to go back to atmospheric pressure. And hopefully I'm due to go back onto the big mountains on the 15th of October.
When you're climbing big mountains, Jason, and maybe you're struggling and it's a huge physical challenge and the sickness of altitude, what goes through your head? Are you focused on the next step and the next move, or do all kinds of thoughts go through your mind?
I think this comes back to the conversation we had earlier about the apprenticeship as mountaineering. And this is where when people come through the apprenticeship as a musician, the apprenticeship as a climber, the apprenticeship as an electrician, mechanic, they can see the challenges ahead and they can deal with them physically, mentally and emotionally. So again, starting out, you know, my message to anybody listening to this is, if you're starting out and you do have an ambition to climb something major in your life, have the courage to start at the bottom and work through the process. And there you will learn how to handle your physiology, how to learn your emotional trauma that comes with isolation, cold, hunger, lack of sleep, altitude, the cerebral edema, which is your brain swelling, pulmonary edema, which is your lungs filling with liquid. These are physiology effects that happen with altitude and with the change in atmospheric pressure. And life's like that. I mean, if we even dial this whole thing back to life, life is the roller coaster of highs, lows, successes and failures. And to be honest with you, Richard, you know, when I look back, yes, I could have done without the bully. Yes, I could have done without Bully's accident and Mum's death. Yes, there's times I would wish it didn't happen. And look, without doubt, I wish Creesa had never happened. I wish I was never there that day. But I was, and I did all I could do. And all these things are a roadmap to life. Success for me isn't those mountains. It isn't standing on those mountains. I don't think I'm any better than anybody else. They are just my way of growing, surviving, and getting through life. But the greatest gift that I've learned through this whole journey is having the courage to help somebody else that's struggling through life. And I think that's the best bank balance that I'd have. That is the best trophy that I'll ever hold. And it is the best summit that I'll ever stand on. Having the courage to help somebody else in Africa, at home, or in Nepal, that is really struggling through life. And that by using my strength as an individual, the highs and lows, and my wisdom, that I can help lever somebody else's success.
Jason Black, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
Thanks, Richard.
If you've been impacted by any of the issues raised by Jason, you can go to rte.ie helplines for more information.